Worship, the result of seeing the hand of God. An exposition of Genesis chapter 8, verses 1 through 22. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, June the 20th, 2012.
It's the kind of thing I just can't even imagine. I don't think anyone can even begin to comprehend what must have been going on in his heart and his mind. I mean, I've had those times when I felt like I was isolated. You know, you've had those times when you just felt alone. Your family may have been around you, other people may have been around you, but circumstances and just how you were feeling about the circumstance, you just thought, it's just me. I'm just all alone out here. But what must it have been like for him? Months of bouncing around on a worldwide sea, the stench and the noise of all those animals, the quarreling of his family going stir crazy, and living with the knowledge that everyone and everything he had ever known was buried deep beneath him in a watery grave. I mean, these are the kind of things that we don't typically think of. We're familiar with the story of Noah and the flood, and we believe it to be true, and we say, well, this is God's word, and God doesn't lie, and so when he speaks, it's true, and I have no trouble accepting and saying that I believe it's literally just as the scripture tells it. I believe there was a man named Noah who found favor in the eyes of God, and he was preserved, and God destroyed everything on the earth. But how often have I stopped to think what that actually meant? How often did I stop and give thought to what it would be like to be bouncing around in a boat for months waiting for the day that you were going to come out knowing you would be the only people on the face of the earth? I can't imagine the difficulty that must have been. I also wonder what was going on inside that ark. Because the clear implication of the text, as I read it in Genesis, seems to me to imply that God didn't have a whole lot to say during that time. They bounced around in silence. What must it have been like? I think too often we think of the flood and Noah's experience as if they were just on a weekend cruise of some kind and they were just out for this night little boat ride, and when it was all over they got on with the business of living. I can't imagine the emotions that they must have gone through. I can't imagine what it would be like to feel the grief and the loss of friends and loved ones who had been destroyed. Not to mention the fact that you would have been haunted by the question, why was I chosen to survive? How did I find favor in the eyes of God? Finally, after what seemed to be an eternity, the rain stopped. Then after months of bouncing back and forth, the ark landed on Mount Ararat. Months later, the tops of the mountains became visible. Another month passed and Noah opened the window and released a raven as a scout. Later he released a dove. And after a few more weeks, the word came from God commanding that they leave the ark. Now, we know from the text that God had assured Noah and his family that he would deliver them. Do you think they ever doubted? You know, the men and women of Scripture were men and women of flesh and bone. They weren't superheroes. They didn't have talents and gifts and abilities beyond us. Common, ordinary people made of clay, just like us. And I think they doubted. I think there must have been a time that Noah thought, what if we spring a leak? God said he would preserve, but will he really? Will he ultimately? And what are we to find when we exit this boat? What would have been your first thought when you left the boat and put your feet on solid ground? I mean, I've tried to think about it, and I honestly don't know. I may have kicked up my heels and said, I'm alive. I don't know. I don't know what I would have done, but I know what Noah did. And the first thing he did was worship God. And there's a lesson for us in that. Our text tonight is found in Genesis chapter 8. The first 11 chapters of Genesis are dealing with real, actual history. It's not an allegory. It's not an epic poem of some kind that's there to just teach us some truth. It's recorded history. It's about a real person. It's about a real family. It's about a real God who really did the things that are recorded in those 11 chapters. In Genesis, we find real truth, but it's not exhaustive truth. See, when I say that this book is God's revelation, and when I say that it's inerrant and infallible, that doesn't mean it's exhaustive. He didn't tell us everything. He couldn't. If he did, you wouldn't be carrying it around. He told us what we need to know. Not everything there is to know. And there are a lot of questions, and I understand that, but he does tell us what we need to know. We understand how we got here, who put us here, and what happened to us. And that's what we need to know and to understand. Genesis 5 provides us with this not, or Genesis 6 verse 5 provides us with this not so flattering description of man, which is the cause of his judgment. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continuously. That's not the picture we want to think of us. That's not the way we would want to describe ourselves. But this was God's understanding of man and what he'd become. God's good and glorious creation had been ruined. Man was not what he was created to be. And as a result of Adam's rebellion, and as a result of the judgment of God, the whole of creation was ruined. And in a short time, we reach Genesis 6, where every intention of the thoughts of the heart of man was only evil continuously. Again, we have to define evil in terms as God defines it, not as terms of we define it. It was opposed to God. It was opposed to the will of God. It was opposed to the things of God. It was centered on self, and it was evil and wicked in the sight of God to the point that God had to do something about it. The text tells us he was sorry that he ever made man. And if that were the end of it, it would be unfortunate, but we could all live with it. But that's not where it ends. Our problem is, God said, so, I'm going to wipe the slate clean. I'm going to destroy every living thing on the earth. And that's where we get uncomfortable. Because most of the time, we're uncomfortable when God starts acting like God. God is loving and gracious and merciful and kind. He's also righteous and holy. He said in the beginning, the soul that sins will die. There is a price to pay for rebellion. And when Adam rebelled, there was a price to pay. In grace and mercy, God reached out in love and compassion. But it was grace. He didn't owe it to them. God didn't owe it to them to drive them out and let them live. They could have died on the spot and God would have been just. But he chose to love. And even in his judgment, when he was sorry he ever made man, he was gracious. In the pronouncement of just judgment, we find grace. In verse 8 of chapter 6, Noah found favor in the eyes of God. Noah found grace in the eyes of God. It wasn't earned. Because if it's earned, it's not grace. Grace is unmerited, unearned, undeserved favor from the hand of God. And Noah found favor because God is gracious, not because Noah was righteous. His righteousness was the result of God's grace and work in his life. It's by grace alone that any of us are delivered, and it is by grace alone that Noah and his family were spared. It was God himself who sealed up the ark because he doesn't trust the safety of his people to anyone else. He himself is responsible. Chapter 7 then gives us the account of the flood, and now in chapter 8, what happened immediately after the flood. Again, I'm convinced there's a valuable lesson. Even life's greatest tragedy can serve as the backdrop of worship if we can see beyond the tragedy the hand of God. That's the issue. Too often when heartache and trial comes, the only thing we look at is the heartache and the trial. When some great tragedy strikes us, it's easy to focus on that tragedy rather than see the greater picture, rather than to see the greater story. And that's what I mean by see beyond the tragedy the hand of God. It's easy to stand and say, I believe in the sovereignty of God. But if you believe in the sovereignty of God, then you can't just hold to that and believe it when everything's good in your life. You have to also embrace it when all hell breaks loose. You have to also embrace it when everything's going wrong in your little world. You have to believe in the sovereignty of God as much when you are healed of cancer as you do when you lose your job. Or when you're treated horribly by coworkers or family or neighbor. God is still God. God is still in control and He is still sovereign. Three things I want us to see out of chapter 8. The first, God initiates worship by responding to the needs of His people. That's in the first 19 verses of chapter 8. God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. God made a wind to blow over the earth and the waters subsided. The fountain of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens were restrained and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. The 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that had been made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him, to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. And the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him, to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back in the evening. Behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. And then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return any more. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and everything, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by families from the ark. Worship starts with God and God's act and God's mercy and God's grace. That's true of every aspect of our life. Salvation begins with God. Prayer begins with God. Worship begins with God. Evangelism, missions begin with God. It all starts there. His reaching out. Verse 1 tells us God remembered Noah and all the animals and the livestock. Now the word remember means more than he'd called to mind. It's more than just, oh yeah, I remember now. They're in the boat. It's not remembered in the sense that God said, oh yeah, kind of short, balding, yeah, I remember. But it means to keep faith with. It means to deliver on a promise. It means to do what you declared you would do. It is a memory that results in an action or a response. It's the same word that's used in Exodus 2 in verse 24 when the children of Israel were crying out to God from Egypt and God remembered His people. It has to do with God's keeping covenant. It has to do with God being faithful. So when we read in the beginning of this chapter, God remembered, it's God as being faithful to Noah and the animals. All of those that He has preserved, He is being faithful to them. He didn't forget them. Through all those months of silence, when there was doubt and there was confusion, God never forgot them. But here again, He manifests Himself. He promised to protect, to save and to deliver, and He now made good on His promise. And He's prepared to bring them forth from the ark. Because He remembered them, He sent a wind over the earth to dry up the water. Because He remembered them, the waters receded. Everything that happened was because of God's faithfulness in keeping and preserving and maintaining His promise. It's interesting that to note the similarities throughout this section with that of the creation account. It is a new beginning. God remembers His people. A second thing, in verse 20, God's grace provokes worship. Noah and his family came out, and Noah, verse 20 says, built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Noah's response was the worship of God. The first thing he did was to build an altar and offer a sacrifice. Again, I think that's important. I think it's important for us to note. He bowed down in reverence. He built an altar and he offered sacrifice. He remembered God who had remembered him. It's relatively easy to think about God in good circumstances, but not always in the difficult times once we experience deliverance. We think about God when we're complaining. We think about God when we're crying out. But then once He delivers, we tend to go on our merry way. But Noah stopped and built an altar. And he offered both a thank offering and a sin offering. Now why would he do that? I think the whole time they bounced around on the sea, Noah was thinking, why are we going through this? And he remembered. God was sorry He made man, because man was evil. And his thoughts were evil. And in his heart there was corruption. And Noah's thinking, I know my heart. And I know I'm no better than those who drown. How do I know this isn't going to happen again? And how do I know it isn't going to happen to my family? He hadn't received that promise yet it isn't going to happen again. And so he offered a sin offering. And he offered a thank offering. He was acknowledging his need, his dependence upon God. He saw God's judgment as right. He saw God's judgment as righteous and holy. He feared for his life, and so he offered sacrifice for both him and his family. In doing so, he acknowledged his need of atonement. He acknowledged his need of another to deliver him. He was pleading for God's continued mercy and his grace. But this plea, this crying out, is in response to what God had done. Because God had been gracious, because God had been merciful, he knew he could approach him and cry out for mercy. Third thing, genuine worship pleases the heart of God. Verse 21 and verse 22. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. In this context, God announces a covenant with Noah and all the living creatures. But what I want you to note carefully is verse 21. This covenant is not due to some great change on man's part. Look at it. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. That's a good thing. What does he go on to say? For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Sound familiar? Same thing that he said about him back in chapter 6 and verse 5. What is the basis for God's never doing it again? It's not because we learned a lesson. It's not because we were improved, because he spared good old righteous Noah, and we are descended from old Noah, and therefore, no, in his own heart, in his own mercy, in his own kindness, God has chosen to never do it again. It's the grace of God. It's unmerited. It's undeserved. Noah didn't do anything to deserve it. And neither has anyone since. It's owing completely to the love and the mercy, the grace of our kind God. Three characteristics of covenants with God that are established in the Scripture. They're unilateral. They're established by God. It's not two parties in entering into an agreement. Do you remember when God made that agreement with Abraham? And he caused a sleep to come on Abraham, and then he cut the animal and he laid it out in two pieces, and God walked between. The way you cut a covenant was the two people who were in agreement about something would cut the animal, lay it open, then the two would walk through in an agreement saying, let this happen to me if I don't fulfill this. God didn't walk through with Abraham. God went through alone because God said, I'm keeping this covenant. It has nothing to do with you. God made a covenant with Noah, and he said, no, it had nothing to do with you except that you are the beneficiary of it. It is the love and grace and mercy of God because they're not equal. It's not an agreement between two equal people or two equal parties. God is eternal and holy and just and righteous, and man is mortal and corrupt and sinful. God enters into covenant by grace. Now the point of all of it is, regardless of what tragedy you are going through or have just come out of or you're on your way to, it can be the occasion for genuine worship. if, in the tragedy, you ask yourself some important questions. What does this reveal about God? What does it teach me about His dealings with His people? Look beyond the tragedy to the hand of God. Pastor, I understand that, and I appreciate it. But what if I can't see it? What if I can't see His hand? And let's be honest, you can't always see it. When I, back in March of 1995, went with this little ear problem I had, and the doctor said, well, I don't think this is it, but let's test for it anyway. And then after another few days of testing, he called me early on a Thursday morning. I can remember it vividly. At 7:30 in the morning, he called to say, Rod, yeah? It's Dr. Duché. Yes, sir. Got your test results. I said, okay. He said, it is a tumor. And just hold tight. I'll get with the specialist, and we'll see how soon we can get this scheduled, because we got to do it as quickly as possible. Well, my first response wasn't, why I see God's hand in all of this. I didn't see it at all. I didn't understand it at all. Years later, mom's having health problems, and yeah, it's decaying, it's getting worse, and we're going to have to do something, and finally, we're going to have to amputate. Have to take your leg. Been through that with Dad, understood that okay. So she struggles for a full year having this amputation and going through all the pain and trying to rehab and trying to get back. And after a long struggle with that, they fit her for an artificial leg, and she just started. I mean, once or twice it seems like to the therapist to try to learn to walk again. And the doctor says, you got a problem in the other leg. And in a matter of a few weeks from that, you're in the hospital, we're going to have to take your other leg. And while in the hospital, after having the second amputation, the other leg, she died. On a Sunday, while Dad came to church, left her for long enough to come to church, and on his way back gets a call that she's gone. I'm on my way to lunch and get a call. I didn't see God's hand in that. In fact, I was angry about it. Because I said, why did she suffer for a full year for no purpose? Why did she go? I don't understand that. So what do you do when it isn't evident? What do you do when you've looked for it and as far as you can tell, it isn't there? By faith, we know that God's hand is in everything. We know that God orchestrates all things. And it's ultimately for our good and for His glory. So as Spurgeon said, when you cannot trace His hand, trust His heart. He's too kind to be cruel. He's too wise to make mistakes. So when you cannot trace His hand, trust His heart. Tragedy is an occasion for worship. But for it to be an occasion of worship, we have to look beyond the tragedy and see the hand of God. Most of the time, we're going to have to do that by faith. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things we can't see.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.